The third partial shutdown of the U.S. government in 3 months is having less obvious effects than the others.
Funding ran out for the Department of Homeland Security, though key employees like airport security remain on the job. Rather than immediate chaos, the funding lapse points to a larger issue, the consistent failure by Congress to do its job on time. The missed deadline does make it harder for the government to think ahead, and it's become routine.
NPR congressional reporter Sam Greenglass was listening to lawmakers as they didn't work things out over the past several days. Sam, good morning.
Hey, Steve.
Why does this keep happening?
Yeah, so this latest effort seems to be following, I guess, a familiar cycle. A crisis captures national attention, in this case, the deadly shootings of two U.S. citizens by immigration agents in Minneapolis, or recently, health subsidies expiring and spiking premiums. Mm-hmm. A number of Democrats and Republicans suggest that they will respond, like when Republican Senator Bernie Moreno said last month that a bipartisan deal to save the subsidies was in the red zone, only for talks to fizzle, leaving both sides pointing fingers.
Shouldn't we be here trying to figure out how to solve problems rather than trying to figure out how to score political points for the purposes of the next election?
Well, is that a fair assessment that Congress can't get anything done?
Yeah, some lawmakers would push back, like Republican Senator Susan Collins. I asked her why bipartisan talks seem to keep crumbling, and she rejected that idea, pointing to all the spending bills that Congress has agreed to.
I don't know how you could possibly describe that as crumbling. That's Congress reasserting its power of the purse.
Okay, that's an interesting argument. Congress has been very, very obedient over the last year, and she's saying, actually, no, now we're pushing back and funding things the way we want to. Mm-hmm. But why is it difficult for Congress to act on these hot-button issues that get a lot of public interest?
I put that question to former Democratic Senator Heidi Heitkamp, and she told me that once the shock of a crisis wears off, lawmakers go back to their corners. And while bipartisan deals have always been delicate, many lawmakers today see less incentive as politics becomes more tribal.
The base on both sides, their willingness to reward compromise is greatly diminished.
And Democratic Senator Tim Kaine says that on some issues, finding consensus is just really hard.
On health care, on immigration, the parties are in fundamentally very, very different places.
Okay, so let's circle back to this DHS shutdown, the partial shutdown. Any progress toward an agreement over the weekend?
The White House and Democrats have been trading offers, but Democrats have described Republican proposals so far as insufficient, and Republicans are calling Democrats' demands unreasonable, like requiring judicial warrants for some enforcement operations. And judging by how fast lawmakers left D.C. last Thursday for a week-long recess, the two sides are still far apart.
Could this shutdown last long enough that we could feel some effects?
Members have been told to be ready to come back this week if there's a deal. Meanwhile, immigration enforcement will continue. Congress already gave ICE billions of dollars last year. Disaster response has money to work with for a while, and TSA agents won't miss a paycheck for a few weeks. So most Americans may not notice this shutdown unless it drags on.
Okay, we'll see what happens in days to come. NPR's Sam Greenglass, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Russian, Ukrainian, and American officials meet in Geneva, Switzerland tomorrow for another round of negotiations focused on the war in Ukraine.
Yeah, the talks come as the Russian full-scale invasion nears its four-year mark.
Hard to believe it's been 4 years. NPR's Charles Maines has been covering it all. He's on the line from Moscow. Hey there, Charles.
Morning.
Is there anything about these talks that would suggest they would turn out any differently than all the other talks?
Well, you know, President Trump's preferred negotiators for seemingly everything these days. That's White House envoy Steve Witkoff and Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner. They're representing the U.S., and they've been rather upbeat about the prospect for a deal.
Okay.
But in remarks at the Munich Security Conference over the weekend, Secretary of State Marco Rubio was far more cautious, particularly when it came to Russia.
The answer is we don't know. We don't know if the Russians are serious about ending the war. They say they are, and under what terms they were willing to do it, and whether we can find terms that are acceptable to Ukraine upon that Russia will always agree to. But we're going to continue to test it.
testing what the Russian position is. Is it clear to you what the Russian position is as you listen to people there in Moscow?
Well, the Kremlin's line here is it prefers diplomacy to conflict, but that Russian victory is also inevitable. So give us what we want or we'll take it by force. But I think we have to be clear that this is also part of the Russian strategy in its negotiations with the White House to try and convince the U.S. that Ukraine's cause is hopeless. Moreover, the Kremlin is suggesting that once this war is settled, the U.S. and Russia can get back to business with massive investment opportunities. And White House negotiator Steve Witkoff in particular has made clear he sees business and profits as key to bridging differences between a post-war Russia and Ukraine.
Oh, that's really interesting. So the Russians are saying if you just go along with us, there's money to be made. The Americans are interested in making the money, but they still don't even have a deal. So what are the key hangups here?
Yeah, U.S. efforts have really bogged down on the issue of territorial concessions and security agreements. Russia is demanding Ukraine cede territory, including parts claimed but not occupied by Russian forces. Ukraine argues, why should we give up territory that Russia has been unable to take in 4 years? Or if for some reason they were to agree to that, then they certainly want ironclad security guarantees from the West and from the U.S. in particular, some assurance that Russia simply won't come back and attack again. But speaking to Munich over the weekend, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky made it clear he's under pressure from the White House to sign on to a deal.
The Americans often return to the topic of concessions, and too often those concessions are discussed in the context only of Ukraine, not Russia.
Okay, so that's Zelensky's view of this, that only he is being forced to concede and still not getting to a deal. I want to ask about another bit of news on this. European nations had an announcement over the weekend about Alexei Navalny, the Russian opposition leader. What did you hear?
Yeah, today marks 2 years to the day, in fact, since Navalny died in a remote prison in Russia's Arctic. Now, several European countries, including the UK, France, and Germany, say analyses of Navalny's remains that were smuggled out of Russia conclusively confirmed the presence of epibatidine. This is a toxin found in poisonous dart frogs in South America. They're not native to Russia. The U.S. says it doesn't dispute those findings. Russian officials, however, continue to say Navalny died from natural causes. But these European findings would appear to support what Navalny's family and his supporters have certainly always maintained, that he was murdered.
NPR's Charles Maines is in Moscow. Thanks, as always, for your insights. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
U.S. speed skater Jordan Stolz won his second gold medal over the weekend at the Milan Cortina Games.
There were also some super high-profile stumbles. U.S. alpine skier Michaela Schifrin again fell short of a medal.
NPR's Brian Mann is in Cortina d'Ampezzo, Italy this morning. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Layla.
Was Jordan Stolz expected to be this strong?
You know, he came into these games with high expectations, but Stolz is having an amazing run in Milan. He set two Olympic records here, including this 500-meter race Saturday. He's the first male speed skater to win the 500 and 1,000-meter races in one game since 1980. But not such a strong outing over the weekend for U.S. speed skater Erin Jackson. She won gold in the 500-meter 4 years ago, but finished fifth yesterday. And as mentioned, alpine skier Michaela Schifrin also finished well behind the front runner Sunday. This was her eighth straight Olympic event, dating back to the Beijing Games, where she's failed to medal. She spoke to reporters afterwards. She said she feels really hopeful going into her last race here on Wednesday, the slalom. It's her best chance to break this Olympic losing streak.
Now, Ryan, Schifrin and Jackson are not alone. A bunch of athletes who are expected to boost the U.S. medal count are going home disappointed. And you've been looking at the science behind this. What have you learned?
Yeah, you know, the brain is a wonderful thing, but scientists I've been talking to say sometimes it gets in the way of elite athletes. After he fell repeatedly in his figure skating program Friday, Ilya Malinin talked about the pressure of the Olympics. He told reporters all his preparation kind of unraveled. Dr. Sian Gupta is a sports performance psychologist and researcher at the University of Portsmouth in England. He's an expert on this phenomenon. It's known as the yips or the twisties.
You know, yips, twisties, these are actually very highly studied. So the technical term of that is performance failure or performance blocks.
Gupta says athletes train for this pressure. They work with therapists. They have all kinds of tricks for quieting the brain and letting their deep muscle training take over. Everything from meditation to listening to loud music to dancing. But the unique pressure that happens at the Olympics sometimes overwhelms all that preparation.
In most sports, it's about a 10-minute period every 4 years. That's when you're actually competing in the finals for the medals, right? This is what we characterize as an acute and immediate stress environment.
But Leila, there is one hopeful thing here. Experts tell me athletes who fall apart at one Olympics often learn from it. They come back stronger. You'll remember the figure skater Nathan Chen fell apart at the Winter Olympics in South Korea, then triumphed 4 years later. The gymnast Simone Biles withdrew from competition at the Tokyo Games, then in Paris won 3 gold and a silver. So a painful experience for these athletes, but not always the end of the story.
Now, some other countries have seen history-making moments from their top athletes. Who are you watching?
Yeah, big weekend. Let's start with the hometown favorites, Italy. Such a great story. Alpine skier Federica Brignone shattered her leg in a crash less than a year ago. She's come back to win 2 gold medals so far here in Cortina. She won the giant slalom yesterday. And then there's Norway, where cross-country skier Johannes Klebo made history over the weekend. He's won 4 gold medals so far here. He has 9 gold on his career. That's the most of any Winter Olympian. And he could add 2 more golds before this event wraps up. And I want to mention one other history-making moment here over the weekend. Lucas Pinheiro Braathen won gold skiing for Brazil in men's giant slalom. And Leila, it turns out this is the first Winter Olympic medal ever for an athlete from South America.
Amazing. Okay, NPR's Brian Mann in Cortina this morning. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.